everything's content. You shaved your mustache.
You know, I the person that I've been kissing recently doesn't want to have the mustache.
There is there's an in-between phase of mustache that is unpleasant for the kiss receiver.
It's basically just a whole 100%. Bunch of, you know,
needles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. There is you have to achieve kind of a general gravitational pull downward that makes it more sustainable and survivable. But there is definitely a buzz cut version of it that's like just pure agony, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a scrubber. I try to negotiate past that stage, but you know.
Yeah. And, you know, like. Hey, you give it.
I got bigger fish to fry.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I don't
need
to win that argument.
How are you doing? This is we haven't had just a two of us.
I don't know what to say to you.
Too long, right? Yeah.
We've had so many guests. We've had like a string of guests, and trying to change the story a little bit. We had John Lacks. We had Craig Bryant. We had Tracy Halverson.
Yep.
We had
Strangle.
I mean, we've had a lot of fun conversations.
Yeah.
And it's kind of it's weird to be back in the fold, just the two of us.
Yeah. It's and we're at episode 32, which is nuts. Like that's
wow, how did that happen?
32 episodes, yeah. And I would be remiss if I didn't shout out Bart here as well for saving our John Lacks video from last week from the disastrous kind of Zencastr experience we had. We're still on Zencastr for now, but we'll see. Zencastr is definitely on the naughty list, but you know, we're limping along with Zencastr right now.
It's 2024. All the technology works perfectly all the time.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Thank goodness. We finally arrived at a point where all the technology works perfectly.
It seems like, in all my other lives where I'm doing work that involves capturing other voices and building articles, blog posts, podcasts around those voices. The thing that's been on my mind and their minds almost this entire last season, let's just talk about the last quarter, is why now in 2024 do we have way more complicated shit than we did first started out? Because the promise was everything was going to get easier. But in fact, it's getting way, way, way more difficult to just, I don't even know where shit is.
100%.
Just even starting this podcast.
100%.
I was looking for the right calendar to click the right link.
Right, right.
And I couldn't find it. I was I was logged into the wrong account.
No, I've used your term for this a dozen times now, this whole Frankenstack thing where
Frankenstack, yeah.
So many... Like that, and that is truly the bane of my existence is where was that comment that I saw? Where was it? Like someone asked me a question or someone posted a thing or someone shared a thing or whatever, where the hell was that? And God forbid it's in threads in Slack because I'll never effing find it for the rest of my life. Like, God forbid it's a threaded comment in a Slack channel somewhere because that's where shit goes to die. But like was it a comment in a Google Doc? Was it something in fucking Notion? Was it in Figma? Is it in this Discord? Was it an email? Like the just finding where that question was asked so that I can somehow refer back to it and answer it, you know, God forbid hours later and not in the moment. Like it is like finding a needle in a needle stack to find this stuff. It is outrageous. And you know, and you work with lots of people. I work with lots of people. I'm working with people that feel like they want me to drag a little bit more towards working in Notion. I work with people that work a little bit more in Google Docs. I work with people that are trying to work in Figma. I work like they're all trying to do the same things and they're all doing their own version of it. And my constant, I was just bitching about this earlier this morning. My constant feeling is like what I need to do in Notion is just outside my grasp. Like it's just 1 inch outside of my grasp to know how to do this actual thing in Notion that I'm actually trying to do because I'm not getting a PhD in Notion. Like, I've watched a YouTube video. I've tried to like bone up on it. I'm trying to like figure my way through it. But why, when I turn this database into a timeline, is it blank when there are dates in the blocks? Like, it's just that kind of stuff. Because, you know, and worse for me in a lot of cases than it is for most people, because most of my work is this. Most of my work is Zooms, is video calls. It's not a lot of documenting. 15% of my time is spent in a tool like Notion or a tool or Google Docs or whatever. I live in Slack, my inbox, and video conferencing. So I don't even have enough like day-to-day hours to build up my 10,000 hours in Notion. It'll take me until I'm 75 to get my 10,000 hours in Notion because I don't work in it enough. But
yeah, they will have brought another version out by then and you will be back to square.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Yeah. Like, you know, with but one of my clients...
This is a good entry point into a conversation, which we've had before, but yeah. I think needs more clarity around. And we need a term for it. Maybe it's degrowth or ungrowth or some anti-growth. Like, it's not anti-growth in the sense of like, I'm still really pro learning, experiencing, understanding, right. Like the right. growth aspect of my personal and professional right, human right, being. Right. Like, I'm just super into that. And I'm always going to be that like yeah. massive nerd about like improving those things.
Yes.
But in almost every aspect of my life, I want things to be simpler.
Yes.
And by simple, I mean like dramatically simpler. Like, I don't yeah. want as many tools. I don't want as many things like physical objects.
Yeah.
I did a big clean out over the last couple of weeks. I've been giving away a lot of my books. I have probably like 5 times the number of books that are in the background here.
Yeah.
That still remain after me giving away like more than half of them.
Right.
We talk about giving away like thousands of dollars worth of books, but
right.
I don't read them. And they're not, all they're doing is signaling that I read. They don't do right. anything else. So I got to give them to people who will read them. So I take them to the library and I donate them and give them to friends and whatnot, because they're not doing anything here. And it's the same in every aspect of our life. If we have a whole bunch of stuff, all we're doing is signaling to a very small group of people that we're better than them, and we're not better than them. So what the fuck are we doing? Like, give this shit away.
Right.
And then like the other part of that is like, just when I think about the specific tools that I use, I do want to think about them through the perspective of like, do I have a handle on email? Because I don't want to add Slack to email. I don't want there to be this non-substitution effect. I want a substitution effect. I'm like, okay, so we're going to add another thing.
Right.
What gives? Like, what do we sacrifice for that? Yeah. And there should be this constant trade-off conversation. I was like, and I have this with my kids. They were like, oh, we should get this. I'm like, well, what would we get rid of so that we could make space for that?
Yeah, I think
it's physical or like a game on it. You're like, otherwise, it's like, oh, Dad, can I have another 2 terabyte hard drive to download yet another fucking game that I'm never going to play?
Right. Yes. I think when you're, what I like about what you're saying is like, there's gotta be a way as an organization, let's say, to grow while uncomplicating. Like, that's the negative of this.
The way that you say that, it almost sounds as if the two things are diametrically opposed, but I'm starting to get to the point where I think that they're the same thing. I think that spiritual awakening, growth as a human being, a kind of an enlightenment, if you will, comes from the decluttering or the defucking of your life.
Right.
Unfucking of shit. Like, the fewer things that you're attached to, like physical objects.
Yeah.
The few toxic relationships that you have. Like, I don't want to have like a million friends. I want to have the friends that really care about me and vice versa. I want to have a really, really good thing that I love using. Like, if I go to my kitchen, I've got this one knife and it's just immaculate and it's beautiful. I don't need 25 knives because that's what I have. I like go into the drawer and I'm trying to find the knife.
Right.
Maybe I'm just like overly engineering, like under engineering my life, but I do want it to be one of those.
Right.
There is one thing for me to think about. There is one t-shirt for me to wear.
Right.
There is a version of that feels very enlightened. That feels quite clear, like clearly closer to an awakening and a clarity and a simplicity than, I need to like increase the scope of my understanding here. And this, sorry, this is a guy that has like a podcast on AI and, you know, writes articles on technology every single day. Like, I have way too much going on. I admit that. I'm not like saying that I've solved this problem. What I'm saying is I would like to solve this problem.
Right. But I think to right. So to kind of say this back, maybe say a different way, like there is a version of company growth, enterprise growth, product growth, whatever, where they get excited about trying to solve all the problems. They get excited about like how vast their solution can be and like all that they can offer. And there's like this expansiveness that leads to a version of growth, but leads to like an amazingly, increasingly complicated thing, which leads to inefficiency and all the things that, you know, we complain about, right?
Well, a lot of that growth is like the number of things, but it's not growth in terms of like understanding or clarity.
Exactly. So like if you were to calculate that growth by raw numbers, it would look like a lot of money, or it would look like a lot of whatever. But if you actually scrutinize the value of each individual instance within that overall, like the value of each instance is really low because it's just basically an accumulation of thousands and thousands of thousands of things. When you stack them all up, looks like a lot of money, or it looks like a big company, or it looks like a lot of value. And when you get in and scrutinize it, it's actually filled with a lot of Rice Krispies. There's Rice Krispies everywhere.
Totally. That's exactly what's happening right now is companies are realizing they're going to have to, for some reason, maybe because they overhired or they overinvested or whatever, they're going to have to undo some of that stuff.
Yes.
And they're doing it. And then they're going, shit, we let go 40% of our people and nothing bad happened. I mean, obviously losing the jobs for those individuals.
I'm not saying that.
But the company itself starts to go, wow, we certainly can do as much, if not more, with less.
Right.
So doing more with less is really what I'm saying. And I was actually just in a leadership meeting with one of the companies that I advise, and their product has grown, right? It's become many, many pieces of a much larger conversation.
Yeah.
And really what we ended up doing is thinking about like how to not do those things. Like how do we do the one thing that we do exceptionally well, much better, and slowly start to defund or sunset or just ignore. Like, oh, you want to use that, great, but we're not going to maintain it anymore. It's not like we're not going to go out there and spend money and engineering time fixing the thing that we built 10 years ago that five people use.
Yes.
And do we end up maybe disappointing a couple of people in the process? It's possible. I don't think it's necessarily going to happen, but I think a lot of us feel this sense of shame or humiliation when we stop doing things that we've been involved in. Like, At a personal level, it might be a friendship. It could be a relationship. It could be a marriage. It'd be like, well, I'm kind of like deeply invested in this and I've been doing it for a long time, so I should just keep doing it.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, you're almost like guilting yourself into sticking around. Like,
yeah.
I don't really want to pick up the phone because this person's a real irritation to me, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
I think credit to us, I think there is a version of you and I taking a stab at this podcast where we say to ourselves, like, let's just do 8 episodes. Let's just do 8, do a season, see how it goes, give ourselves an out. It would be embarrassing to stop. It would be embarrassing to quit. It would be embarrassing to like start this thing, make some noise about it and stop doing it. That would be embarrassing. And the truth is, it doesn't need to be embarrassing. You're allowed to stop doing things. Frankly, people aren't paying that much attention. And they're not going to really notice, and they're not thinking about you nearly as much as you think they are. But that is often like a survival skill people will build into something like this so that they can have a credible out and not look like they quit on something. And quitting is seen like surrender, or it's seen like failure. And truly, to your point, an enlightened person edits and winnows down to the really important things, and shedding those things is a good thing, not quitting. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, because in any enlightened moment, you're living in the present. And so the question you're asking yourself is, where do I need my attention in this moment? So when one of the things that I like about podcasting is that it forces me to be in the moment. Mm. It's not a, like right now, there's not a lot going on. I might truly I could be interrupted. There could be other things happening. Yeah. You know, my phone could ring, but I've turned most things off and I'm generally not worried about that. The only thing I'm worried about is if the school needs to get hold of me.
You know, right. Exactly.
So your son has been rushed to the hospital. What am I? Okay, I'll finish the podcast and then I'll go and see him. But anyway, the point is, like, when you are present and you are focused on that now moment,
yeah,
you disassociate yourself from the moments past and the moments future. Right. And what that gives you is this, like, think about it physically. A hoarder hoards stuff because, well, they might just need it. It right. had value once upon a time.
Right.
And it may still have value in the future. So really what they're saying is, I live in the past.
Right.
And I live in the future.
Uh-huh. Right.
And but I don't live for now. Because right. in the moment now, the question is, do you need that thing? And the answer right. is, I mean, I haven't touched it for years.
Yes.
So if you walk around your house and you see, well, those, like these books, like there are books here that I haven't looked at for ages, years. Yeah. And if I did really go and look at those books, I'd say, no, they're kind of outdated, or I don't think I'm ever going to read them again. Or if I did read them, that would also assume that I needed to do that or I wanted to do that. And could I go back and do that somewhere else? Yeah, there's a library down the road.
Right.
100%. Or Amazon can deliver that book tonight if I really, right. really, really, really need it. So right. Who am I trying to convince here about that future or past moment? Rather think, okay, I need to live in this moment and this is yeah. the present that I'm most interested in. There's a fantastic book. I've read it way, way, way too many times. Mm. And it is a book I'm not going to get rid of. And that is 4,000 Weeks.
Okay.
Oliver Berkman. Wait.
This is the one that you and Tracy and Dave Look and everybody were talking about. And I feel like you've been conspiring to keep this from me.
Well, we, you know, there's a lot that we keep from you. but this is a book which the author, I think he's a journalist. He originally started writing the book as a time management book, as most okay. of us do, because most of us want to scratch that itch. We're like, well, how do we live in the moment? How do we live more presently? How do we have more control over the time that we have? And started writing this book. So the subtitle is 4,000 Weeks, a time management for mortals, something like that.
Okay.
And I started reading it with that same idea. It's like, well, maybe I can get better at managing my calendar. Maybe I can get better at understanding, you know, what my day needs to look like. Just yep. you know, that kind of like hacking mentality. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I think I can hack my way to a better time management. Yeah, I can't even remember when I read this book first, maybe 5-6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realized this book's not about that at all. It's about life. It's this concept of like how to live.
Okay.
And time really is the only thing that we have.
Right.
We think we have stuff. We are like, well, I have money or I have skills or like bullshit. You have none of those things because right. all of those things can get taken away from you in an instant.
Right.
What we only have is our attention, and our attention is what this book is all about. It's this mm-hmm. idea that where you put your attention is ultimately what gets delivered back to you. So if your attention mm-hmm. is on the past, and you're a hoarder because those things had value and you assume that they will still have value in the future.
Right.
Well, then those things make sense to you because you're living in the past and the future.
Right. Right.
But the same with relationships. You're like, well, you know, maybe I'll just hook up with that person that I had a good relationship with 10 years ago because it was good back then.
Right.
In spite of the fact that you both changed, like
right.
you're just living in the past.
Right.
And betting on the future. So a lot of these things are, you know, again, topics we've talked about before, this switching your mindset away from predicting the future. Like, oh, I need to keep this book because I never know when I'm going to need it again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or I'd like to have a big book collection in my house because I want to signal to people right. who I haven't yet met yet
right.
to come to my house to go, oh, he must yeah. be an intellectual because he has lots of yeah, books. Yeah. But really what we need to be focused on is this idea that your only value is in this particular moment. Your only
right.
like true gift is the attention that you're able to give yourself and this thing in yeah. this moment.
Yeah.
And by doing so, you start to realize, you look around, you're like, I have a lot of shit. I have like a lot of stuff yeah. that doesn't help me do anything really.
Yeah.
And then again, whether it's software or tools or physical objects or people, you start to question, like, well, why am I doing these things? And why is my behavior set up like this?
Yep.
And you start to become a lot more aware. And when you become more aware, you give more attention to the present. And it's this self-perpetuating, increasing spiral.
Yep.
Yeah.
This is echoes of what Craig said, right? Craig was saying, I love the way he said this, was it was essentially, don't focus on trying to make the right decisions. Focus on trying to make the decisions right. So rather than all this forecasting, all this prediction, all of this hemming and hawing about the future and really slaving over a decision and putting all this pressure on yourself to get the decision right, instead, make the decision, because you will have time in the present moving forward to make that decision right. Like, just don't worry about that. Don't worry about all of that undue burden. Make the decision, because you will always have time in the future present, tomorrow, the next day, the day after that, to make that decision right. So don't live in the future like that. Don't like put all that pressure on those kinds of decisions. I think that's exactly the same kind of theme.
Well, I think a lot of it comes from, you know, both theological and philosophical influences that suggest that we have a determinism. We have like free will, right? That we have this ability to decide what will be.
Right.
And older I get, the less I'm like, I'm not so sure about that anymore. And like, there's actually some strong physical evidence, like physics evidence, that isn't really the case, is that we're really just kind of weaving our way through this present moment. And as we weave our way through this present moment, we experience different things. And some of those things are good and some of them are bad. Because if you did an inventory of all the good and bad, you'd optimistically say, well, my life's pretty good. But that's because you're still alive. Anybody who's dead right now is not having that experience.
Right.
Right. So it's very odd that we think we have free will when we end up kind of turning out the way we anticipated turning out anyway. Like when you're a kid, you had an idea of what you were going to be, and that's how you ended up being. Like it's not that strange. But what you do have is this ability to give attention to the moment.
Yeah.
In other words, it really stops being important whether you can predict and create and manifest the future. And it becomes way more important that you are present in the thing that you are experiencing right now.
Right.
Because if you're not, you are just wondering about the future. You know, the kind of the metaphysical stuff of like, oh, well, I can predict and manifest the future. Well, really what you're doing is just living in the future. You're not living in the now. You're missing out. Like, you're so busy thinking about what might be or what should be. Like, I'm going to manifest my life where I live on a beach in Spain. Okay, but what about right now? Like, where are you right now? Who are you with right now?
Right.
How are you experiencing life right now? Right. What are you putting in your mouth? What are you doing with your body?
Yeah.
How are you experiencing the world in this moment?
Yep.
And as my buddy who runs a gym says, I can tell you what you will look like in a year's time based on what you're doing with your body right now.
Right.
Yeah, like, show me what your calendar looks like on any given day,
right?
And what you eat and what you do with your body, and I will tell you what you will look like in a year's time. I don't need to be a future,
right?
You know, whatever they call it, futurist. I just look at you now, like,
right?
Like, look at me with your calendar right now, and tell me, and I'll show you what your incentives and your priorities are, and I will tell you what your future looks like.
Yeah, 100%. But I think that, to your point, I often talk about this in terms of opportunity cost. Like, you can only be in one place at one time, and that where you choose to spend your time is incredibly valuable. Like, that's really to your point, that's the only thing you can do is influence. Like, I'm here, I'm doing this right now. I'm choosing this. So as a result, I'm choosing not to do everything else because I'm choosing the one thing. I think that there's value in looking at that, like, there's almost like a tension cost too, right? It's not just your opportunity cost. It's also like kind of where you invest your attention. I use this phrase all the time about, like, when bad things rent space in your brain for free. Like, if you can, like, to me, that is a critical part of just self-help, is trying to figure out how to manage and dial down the noise of other things that you don't want to rent space in your brain for free. Right. So it's hard to do, and it's critically important. I think that.
Well, it's hard to do because we don't do it. It's easier to do when you practice it.
Right. Exactly.
But so anything's hard, right? I mean,
100%.
All things are difficult to, like, learning to walk is hard. That's why kids fall for the first like few years, right?
Yes.
Well, they continue to do that, but it's living is hard. And as you pointed out, the secret is knowing what to ignore and what to not ignore.
Right.
Right. So
and building the media, muscle.
The media's job is to sell your attention to advertisers.
Right.
And so once you become aware of that, you're like, oh, my attention is the product. I am the product.
Right, right, right.
The media company treats me as the product.
Yeah.
And so they have gone out to their advertisers and said, we have products. They're called eyeballs or audience members or whatever they call us.
Yep.
And they say, we have product and we are going to give you that access to that product. And once you make that attention grabbing moment in your head, you go like, oh, so when I'm watching, I mean, it's March Madness. I get it. Like people are watching, they're going to watch the games.
Yep.
You are basically making yourself the product for the media company, for ESPN or I think it's TBS or whoever.
It's all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bunch of channels. Yeah.
So you're now, you've selected to be the product for that company.
Right.
And understanding that changes the way you think about your attention. You go, okay, well, now I have a choice. So I can do a couple of things. So one of the things that I like to do is I would rather pay for a certain kind of experience than pay for it with my attention. Mm. So YouTube is a good example of that. YouTube is essentially an ad platform. But what little, what you know, not that many people know is that you can pay for a version of YouTube where you don't ever see any ads.
Right.
And it's like $10 a month or something.
Right.
And so the math is, do I want to sell myself as the product or do I want to buy the product with the money that I have? And so selected to make that choice. And it was like, I would rather pay $10 a month to have an ad-free YouTube experience than the other way around. Or, you know, cut the cable and say, well, I'm only going to have channels that have non-ad based things.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the kind of, I mean, these are somewhat
small,
but good examples of what you can do with your time.
Yeah.
And so the secret of knowing what to ignore isn't really that much of a secret. It's just an understanding of how the universe works. And if you look around you and you go, oh, am I the product in this thing? Like, am I being sold?
No, that's exactly it. Yeah. If you're not paying for it, you're the product. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's the cheat code for all this, right? Like, so Twitter, like you don't pay for Twitter. Twitter's not the product. You're the product. Like your behavior, what they learn about you, the customer demographic data, all that stuff, like that's what's valuable is your behavior. So if you're not paying for it, you're not getting away with something. Like, it's because you're the product. I just heard this thing on the Hard Fork podcast where they were talking about how auto manufacturers, now GM in particular, is selling your driving data to insurance companies without your knowledge. And then insurance companies are adjusting your insurance premiums based on your driving data without your consent, without like you basically, you sign on for one free month of like Sirius XM radio. And in that Sirius, like is going to communicate back data to the mothership and you sign up for it. And then you cancel Sirius and you don't turn off sex signaling the data back. Like what you don't realize is just because you cut off the 1 month free trial, you have opted into sharing this data back with the platform. And now that's continued to be shared long after you shut off the thing thought you, and not only that, the salespeople are incentivized to sell you into this. Like they're getting incentivized to sell you into sharing your data and all this. So essentially like now you're the product, like you've bought this car, but you're the product because you're the one exhibiting all of this driving behavior. And then you are the one creating, you know, you're like updating all the actuarial boards for the insurance companies with all of your wanton data sharing. And then people are getting new bills in the mail for their new insurance policy based on like, and you can get a report from LexisNexis, I think of all places, about your driving. And it'll show you like you were speeding here and you short stopped there and you sped here and like all this stuff. And it's only becoming, it's only surfacing now. And the auto manufacturers are just like, well, you know, like it's another way for us to make money. Like it's another way for us to make money on top of selling cars is developing user databases about user behavior and then commoditizing that. So there's a ever present risk of being the product. It's just more and more. And it's very invisible now, more and more. Like you used to have to like do whatever, what was the name of the ratings company that would like monitor like
Nielsen.
Nielsen. You had to be like a Nielsen family, right? And they had to pay you to have a box in your house. And like, you had to like opt into.
Oh my God, that was funny. They actually paid you to be.
Right?
Their
to
data
be scrutinized. To yeah. like, and you had to keep like a diary. Like it was a very weird analog thing back in the day, but you had to opt into that very willingly to then have that data shared. I mean, people that pick up pollsters' phone calls, like, have you picked up a phone call to a pollster ever? Like, do you ever answer those phone calls? Like, you know why polling data is wrong? Think about the people that answer those phone calls. What yeah. wackadoos they must be. Like, who the fuck answers that phone call? Like,
yeah.
the loneliest, weirdest people in the world are the ones, like, influencing it's all of the polling bias. Data.
It's selection yeah. bias. It's like when, you know, the planes were landing, the bombers were landing in the Second World War, and they were, like, analyzing where the holes were. And they were like, oh, there's a lot of holes in the wings. We should reinforce the wings. They were like, you're not analyzing the planes that didn't come back.
Right. 100%.
The ones that didn't come back are the ones that have all the data in them.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it is.
So this is the point in the conversation or the podcast where we actually start helping people.
Okay, good.
And
good,
we need to turn our attention from all of these things to like...
From the metaphysical to the physical. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. I mean, this is how we do it. We go on a tangent, and then just when you think you tuned into the wrong show,
that's right.
We bring it all around.
Yeah.
And the reason why a lot of this is on my mind is because if you're running a business, I get this question a lot, especially from agency or service companies or client services businesses. Is like, am I in the right business? Should I be doing this? Like, can you help me make better choices about these things? And then really the only thing that qualifies me to do that is that I did it, but that's it.
Right.
There's no other reason to believe that my experience is anything like their experience.
100%.
However, I have had the opportunity to talk to hundreds, if not thousands of people who are either employed by or run agencies or service companies at both the small size, you know, two or three people in a basement to the medium size, 50, 60, 70 people. To the very large enterprise level service companies, the Accentures, the PwCs, McKinsey's, whatnot. And the universal truth is that less is more. Like there is getting more from less as a strategy or part of your principles. Like if your principles in action allow you to think about what it is that you're doing with your team and the resources that you have, whether that's time, money, or whatever.
Yep.
As we discussed with John Lax last week, the critical framing that changed his business, it changed my business, it changed your business, was no longer billing by the hour, but thinking about the work that we do as a value. Like, what is the value of the work? So that conversation switches. And the reason why that's really, really important for all businesses and not just service companies is that very often we are taking a factory approach to these things. So we're saying, well, we have this person and they're available for these many hours and blah, blah, blah. And the hangover of that, of course, is, you know, what we're seeing is this, you know, the tension around remote work versus being in the office and leasing an office space. And all of that stuff is really just factory-based thinking, right? Why would you lease an office in the first place? Well, because you need to put people in the office. Why do you need to put people in the office? So you can monitor them.
Right.
Or you can give them access to a certain set of tools or, you know, in the factory model, it was like, well, this is where the machine lives. So that's where you've got to go and work on the machine.
Right.
Now the machine lives here, wherever you are, here being kind of that existential here.
Yep.
And the key thing here is when you start to manage your team around either an office environment or a time environment in the sense of like you're taking their time, using some kind of arbitration model, and then selling that time for more to somebody else, you are essentially deciding your own fate. You've made your bed and you will sleep in that bed. Like if you go for a office-based or time-based or a combination of that model, then you are choosing that outcome and you must live with that outcome and you must also live with the consequences. So you must also live with the consequences of, I my talent pool will be only those people that are going to come to the office. Like, you know, Warren over at Plank has said, like, I want a small community-based office where my people can walk to the office or ride their bikes to the office or take public transport there.
Yep.
And it's going to be easy for them. That's great, but then you must live by that.
That is also a constraint. Yeah,
it's a constraint, and it becomes also a cultural principle that you have to live by.
Yep.
So the reason why this is necessary to have this conversation is very often when people are asking me, how do I make my agency or my service company or my even software company, because most of my advisory clients are software companies, mm-hmm. how do I make that more successful? My question is always, well, what do you do to run your company? How do you work? I ask mm-hmm. exactly that. Like, how do you work? Mm-hmm. How do you meet? How do you come to agreements? How do you make decisions? How do you organize, you know, promotions? How do you incentivize those things? I want to know all those hows, because once you tell me how you work, then we can have conversations about, is that how you work because that's what you want? That's a principle right. of what you care about?
Right.
Or you've ended up working like that because, I don't know, maybe that's what other companies did before you, or you did that in your previous role or something like that. And you just were like, oh, or maybe you just haven't thought about it. Maybe you didn't have a model for how you meet or how you
exactly
decide on things.
Yep.
And the most surprising thing for me as an advisor is to go into a company and to look at them and say, why do you do these things and how do you do these things? And for them to always give me that kind of blank look of, I don't know, we never really thought about it.
Right.
That is your strategy. Your strategy is nothing more than the behavior that you've agreed to do with right. each other.
Yeah.
So I'll repeat that again. Strategy is not a plan. Mm-hmm. Strategy is not some kind of very complicated roadmap of all the activities being, you know, orchestrated through whatever components of your business that you've assembled, but it's the behavior of the individuals as a group. Like, so each individually, we're agreeing on this behavior and we've agreed to it. We've said, I will do this thing and you will do this thing. And we will also not do these other things. And we will do that for as long as it needs to happen or as long as it works. And if it stops working, then we'll do something else.
Yeah.
So if I'm a photographer now and I see that every single AI product that's coming out on the market is essentially going to replace me in some way, and I insist on working the same way that I've always worked,
right.
well, then I must live by that. I must live by that outcome.
Yeah, 100%.
The same way that an agency says, I'm going to have an office in a city and pay a lease on that.
Right. Yeah.
Or in some cases, own the building. That's fine as well. I think there are a handful
yeah,
of
agencies yeah, yeah.
that we've met that yes. own the building.
Right.
But you live by the things that you decide on. So
right.
anybody who doesn't want to hire me as an advisor but wants to just benefit from my knowledge, that's it. Ask yeah. yourself those questions. How do we do the things that we do? And are those things there because they truly are benefiting us or because they just happen to be the things yeah. that we do?
Exactly. And to your point, your greater point, like, did we even decide to do this? Like, to do this? Like, we probably didn't. This is probably how we, like, John even said that in his explanation of like how he got to value-based pricing and value-based thinking was, like, he started out with a rate card. Everybody just stole the playbook from advertising agencies. That was just kind of the assumed way that these kind of companies operated. So, you know, had you cornered him 2 years into TNN Lax and asked him, why are you doing these things this way? He would have said, well, they did it this way at Modem Media and they did this way at, like, this is the way it's done. We didn't really think about it that much. We're just doing the way it's done. Now when they turned that corner and started to embrace value pricing and, you know, all those other things, that was them starting to make decisions, deciding to do things this way, deciding to do things that way. It is really, in my experience with the companies I work with, it is really impressive to me when I see them exhibiting deeply idiosyncratic behaviors as a unified whole. Like, it's a weird thing and they all do it. That's interesting. Like, they all do this weird thing. Like, it's not something everybody does. Maybe I don't agree with it. Maybe I do. It doesn't really matter. But, like, and all of them.
Do you see that being mostly, like, those kinds of things, when you see those idiosyncratic things, do you see those things as being things they are consciously doing? They have attention on those things.
Insane.
Or are they completely unconsciously like, oh, we just do this?
I would say that it's like, I would say that it feels like a bit of both. It feels like they are very, very, very intentionally doing these things. And at the same time, it is a very natural thing for them to do because they're super intentional about it. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little bit of a balancer. I would say, though, that like the longer they do it, the more it just feels like a cult where everyone just is like mumbling the same thing unconsciously and they just do it very reflexively. Like, blah, 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 blah. We all do that. Like, it's like a little bit like, Jesus, like they're all just like, They all just like snap into attention and do this thing when the time comes because they're so like rehearsed at it and they're so like right. fluent in it. But I've seen them similarly, companies like this, like implement a crazy, wanton, weird new thing. And it's super intentional and it's super deliberate. And they are relentlessly kind of like repetitive about it until it becomes this like mantra that they all can like just repeat and it becomes the chorus, you know, that, that kind of like behaves in the background. So I think it's like, I think it's super intentional at first. And then it is when it's working, it is reflexive. I mean, that's why smaller businesses are easier to run in a lot of ways, because it's easier for four people to finish each other's sentences than it is for 40, than it is for 400, than it is for 4,000. Like you have to work much, much, much harder to ensure that 40 people all answer or finish the sentence the same way. Then you have to work when it's four people. That's just that's easier to kind of keep four people in the same kind of room, having the same kind of like, you know, direction. It's harder to keep 40 people, and it's harder still for 400, and it's even harder at 4,000. Like I think that's, and I think the only way to really scale that or like to ensure that 10 people or 20 people or 40 people can be on the same page is, to your point, is to be really intentional about it. Like, this is why we're doing this. We are deciding to do this. This is why we're deciding to do this. This is how we're going to do this. And we're going to keep checking in until we are just rote doing this. We are just by habit, like, this is how we do it. Like, that's just kind of the process that takes hold.
Yeah. And it goes, then it goes to repetition as well.
Right.
Because it's not going to land. Not everybody's ready to receive
no.
the story or the idea. Yeah. You know, it might just be like, oh, I wasn't there on that day.
Yeah.
Or it could have been, no, I don't want to change my habits. Like, I've been doing this for 10 years. Like, I don't want to do it differently.
Well, that's when I work with people and they have in their team Basecamp, Notion, Figma, Google Docs, like all these solutions. I think if I could like corner them and interrogate them, like, why do you use all of these different software platforms? And the answer is usually, well, this team member wanted to use this and this team member wanted to use that. And what they wound up doing was not making anybody cranky by saying no. Like, you could say no to 90% of them and say, no. Like, not for nothing, Basecamp does all this shit. And we've had Basecamp for 12 years. Like, Basecamp does all of this. Now, maybe it's not exactly how you would do it. And maybe there's some bells and whistles that are missing and whatever. But like, you could pick any one of those things and say, we are exclusively working in this environment now. We're not going to do anything else. And we're not going to be distracted by anything else. And we're not going to struggle to find things because it's all in this one. But what winds up happening is people don't want to make people uncomfortable or, you know, put them out, have that kind of like, you know, I don't want to do that kind of response to things that's why these things grow like mushrooms. Like, there's like all this crap that just grows in the dark for so long. And then it's like, Jesus Christ, what is this? I think that's what
people are not being intentional. Something I was guilty of is I wanted to know how that stuff worked because, you know, we were in the product design space. And when something new came out, I was like,
yeah, you're like dangerously aware.
Yeah. Like, what is that? And do we need to know how that works? Because I think Slack was a good example. When it first came out, we're like, oh, we can get rid of email. Like, that seems like a significant improvement over work.
Yeah. Right.
It turned out that there was a lie. It was just really good marketing.
Yeah.
And I think as I get older, whatever.
It's campfire.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
If I'm
truly honest with myself, none of those things have improved my existence at all.
Yeah.
In fact, they've only just made it harder.
100%.
What I have realized, and again, this sounds like a cranky old man, but I'd really mean it. Like, if you're a young company and you're trying to grow and you're trying to think about what you should do, and grow in awareness, there is a less is more value to stuff when in terms of like software and things, because you are giving up your attention.
Yep.
I actually just wrote an article on this topic. On this idea that you really just end up having so much attention managing these tools that most of your day is spent administrating the work, not doing the work. And when I say most of your day, like all of your day, like your day is trying to figure out, as you said, like, where is the thing?
Yeah.
And I do imagine that there is a, there is a significant mental health cost to that as well. Like at the end of the day, the fatigue that I feel, you know, so I've gone through experiences where I've had like, you know, deep, deep, deep work periods where I've had 80 hour weeks in my life. And that was my choice. I'm not blaming anybody, but that was what I was doing. And I've also had choices where I was like, look, I'm going to work for an hour or two every day and that's it.
Right.
And I can tell you that my productivity is no different. You know, when you hold those two things, am I making more stuff? Am I involved in more things when I'm working 80 hours a week? Yeah. Am I making myself less healthy as a physical and mental person? Yeah.
Yep.
100%.
Yeah.
And really, if you learn what to ignore, going back to our previous conversation about, you know, the secret to life is understanding that there are very few things that are that interesting that need your attention.
Right.
I had a very, very fortunate experience that when I was quite young, probably about 21, I went to live on essentially a desert island, not a desert island, but a tropical island in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And I lived there for a year. We had no TV. We had no internet. There was no internet back then when I was that old, you know, that young, I should say. And I just didn't have any news. So for a year, every now and then a newspaper would make its way over, you know, in a tourist's handbag or something like that. And you'd, oh my God, there's the Sunday Times, and you'd read it. But what I noticed is when I got back after that year is that nothing really had changed. Like the same newspaper headlines, the same TV headlines, the same radio headlines, they were all the same. Right. They'd been repurposed, or maybe there was a new
nouns were different
character. Yeah. Like now, instead of
exactly,
you know, Gorbachev being the bad guy, it was, you know, I don't know, whoever the next bad guy, Russian bad guy was, or if the country in the Middle East that was on fire wasn't the same, it was almost the same. It was just across the border. They were and I'm not exaggerating. Like the stories were exactly the same.
Yeah.
And what it came to my attention then is, if I'm going to give my attention to the news, then I should do it in an intentional way. I should give my attention to the news that I want to seek out. And so I stopped watching the news, and I came to a conclusion that if the news is that important, it'll find me. Right? If it's really, really, really relevant to me, it'll find, I'll be in the news. I am the news. Right? And the other thing is, there's no part of the news that is being sent to me that isn't also treating me as the product. So I need to go and seek out. So if it's, let's say it's a political issue, I need to go and seek some kind of long form analysis that never made it to the news anyway.
Right. 100%.
And so that freed up hundreds of hours a year for me, thousands of hours a year, because I wasn't watching the news. And that also meant that I could make good choices. So when Facebook came along, I signed up for Facebook, and within a year I was like, this is just news and junk and crap. It's local news and personal news, but it's just junk.
Yeah.
And so I was easily able to say like, oh, I'm not going to do that. So Facebook never became part of my life. Same thing with Twitter. I was on Twitter for a hot second, noticed that it was just, you know, a dumpster fire, turned that off as well.
Yeah.
And so when you make these principle-based decisions about your attention, it's become so much easier to then decide what comes in and what comes out.
Yeah,
and
if
you're a business owner,
you
can make those choices. You can say, we're only going to do these things, or we're only going to choose these tools, or and you will get pushback. People will say, well, you know, you've chosen that we're going to use Figma. Well, Figma doesn't do this one thing. And if we don't do that one thing, the whole world's going to end. And they'll make a really impassioned argument for why you need that. And then you'll say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do without the one thing that you say we need for the next month. And I'm going to just wait another month and see what happens.
Right. And if everything hasn't burned to the ground,
then we'll see. Right. And it's the same thing with purchasing stuff, like purchasing physical objects. I have this rule, even if it's like, I put it in my Amazon cart.
Okay. And let it sit there.
And then I wait 48 hours.
Yeah.
And then 48 hours, I come back. I'm like, I still really want or need that thing. Then I get it.
Right.
I'm not talking about food products. Like this is
No.
I should order dinner. Maybe I'll just wait 48 hours. See if they hang in there.
That would be amazing.
And I always noticed that like nine times out of 10, I'm like, why the fuck did I even?
Yeah, exactly.
You just bail. Why did I need that pony Parks and Rec t-shirt? Like, why did I need that?
You go to hell. No, but I think one thing I would add to that though is, I think that to your point about agency owners and technologists and design thinkers, is you have to acknowledge that you're a sap for these tools. and you have to like double guard yourself against it, right? Like that's the other thing. It's like, it's not just, I agree with everything you said. I have this thing, Figma doesn't do this thing. I want to do this instead because Figma doesn't do that thing. Okay, let's just figure out how to do it a different way in Figma or wait a month and see. But the bottom line is you have to actually have like even deeper commitment to resisting being marketed at, because in our hearts of hearts, all of these agency owners, all of these principals, it's like, ooh, look at this new shiny technology. I want to get my hands on it and see what's there. And ooh, look at like, I remember when like Path came out and Path was like trying to disrupt Foursquare and Twitter. And it's like, ooh, look at the interface. It's like, it is the same thing. It is just presented differently.
Does anybody even use any of those products anymore?
You know what I mean? And all it was gilding the lily. All it was like, well, what if you had Facebook, but it was vertical? Like, what the fuck? Like, what are we talking about? Like, but we are, I think that's in our world in particular, we have to acknowledge that we are gullible as F for these things. And we have to be twice as resistant to like, oh, this new shiny tool. Oh, this new shiny project management software. Oh, this new shiny design tool. It's like, you've just got to recognize like, I'm probably 200% as excited about this as I should be. I should be 50% as excited about this as I feel right now. So I need to like double safeguard against this wanton enthusiasm.
There's a Seneca quote or some of one of these, like, do not desire the things you do not have.
Right.
Because it takes your attention away from the things you do have.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, you're like, oh, but what if I miss out on the next cool thing? Like it won't matter. I'm 54 this year. Yeah. I'll be 54 soon. And when I missed out on something, it didn't matter. It just didn't matter.
Yeah. 100%. That's exactly right. And I think it is to that agency owner, it's just about having like a diet. Like stick to your diet. Like your diet is this. You do these things. Stick to your fucking diet. Stop indulging in these things. Stop, like, everything you need to do could be done by one tool. You just have to, like, embrace, it might be a little bit less optimal in this one thing, and it might be a little bit more cranky over there, but everything you need to do could be done by blank, and you could put 12 product names in that blank, and you'd be fine on any one of them, and none of them are better than the others. And one other thing I wanted to say that would be helpful to somebody, so in the effort to give somebody a tip or something they can apply to their business. This came up recently in a couple of conversations I had, and it comes back to like the, you were talking about like, when you start to look at things, don't be surprised when you're identified as a commodity, when you behave like a commodity. If you track hours, don't be surprised when you're viewed that way. If you hourly bill things, don't be surprised when you're within those extremes.
It's Conway's law. Like however you communicate within an organization.
I love Conway's law.
That's ultimately what it ships. Yeah, that'll ship. Yeah.
Joshua Blankenship explained Conway's law to me like 4 years ago, and I felt like the universe had parted. And I was like, Jesus fucking Christ. I've been thinking about this for years, and someone was smart enough to like condense it down into like a discrete thought. It just felt like, the book had opened for me or something. But I think what becomes part of the challenge that I wish we got to have John back on, because I want to have a whole dialogue with him about like, how do you bridge the gap between a TN and LAX that thinks in terms of value and a client that thinks in terms of hours? Like talk about that, like say more. Like that is the part that I think really people need more help with. I think everybody understands and is excited about.
That is your marketing message then. The reason to be your signal that you send out into the world has to be attracting people who get that. You can't have that conversation after the fact. You can't be in a post-sales conversation saying,
Agreed.
Oh, well, I thought you guys were more like value-based. It turns out you're this. You literally have to attract those people. It's like, you know, every now and then we unfortunately have to use dating metaphors, but it's true. It's like if I go into a crowded bar full of drunken college students, guess what?
I'm going to find exactly
what I'm looking for.
Exactly.
Right? 100%. So if you are signaling that that's what you are into and that's what you want, then that's what you get. And so you have to start at the highest level of your marketing saying, we don't think that this is a good way to work. We think there's another way to work. And position yourself, like always pick something to say, I am not that thing, or we are not that thing, or pick a fight with the 800 pound gorilla and say like, they suck, we're better because of these things. And so that people can immediately say, oh, that person wants something else. They do something else.
Yep. 100%. So to just add a wrinkle to that though, one example of this that emerged with one of my clients was, you know, the agency I work with is very value oriented. They don't track hours. They don't, you know, propose, they don't do any of that kind of stuff. But the client they work with hired a new project manager on their end of things. And the project manager came from a law background. They'd been kind of
It's the end of the relationship.
Right. A legal assistant. And I was like, so first of all, never say the word retainer again, because that word means something vastly different to this person. And you are going to get into like a shit fight. Like you cannot even, never say the R word again. You can never say it again. So like, well, how do we, like, we're expecting a little bit of hours crankiness from this person. What's our argument? Like, how do we kind of.
R word for them is rent. You're going to rent my team.
Well, then I think, but I said similarly, like I think another way you could do this is say, listen, don't think about our work in terms of hours. We think about it in terms of complexity. Some things are very complex. Some things are not that complex. So we don't track how many hours it takes to do a thing, because sometimes complicated things take more time. Sometimes complicated things take more people. Sometimes complicated things need people with more experience. Like we'll communicate to you what we're working on and its complexity. And we could probably do three simple things at once, and we could do one medium thing and one simple thing, or we could do one really complicated thing. Like it's just a way to kind of give them a different grammar of thinking about how this work gets done, rather than, you know, 48 hours, 720 hours, and then locking hours and having this hour. Like no. Like they need some transparency.
That's why the product world has moved to outcomes, right? So we tried this in the product world. We tried to do, oh, we're going to do these things, or this is what our burn down chart looked like. And again, that failed as well. So that's why I would even recommend to your client that they avoid, oh, we're going to do this many things, and rather focus on what is the outcome that you want from us. You want a website that does this, or a product that's great. We'll build that for you. It's going to take about 6 months, and you're going to have to rent us to do that work.
Exactly. Simple. And to your point,
we will keep on checking in with you to tell us, to tell you how much progress we're making towards that outcome.
Yes, exactly.
That's it.
And the brilliance of that is it's elegantly scalable. So if you need, in theory, twice as much stuff in the same amount of time, we're going to charge you twice as much. Like that's a very simple, like you can rent more. There's just, we just imagine a swim lane. And these things flow through the swim lane at this pace. If you need more things to flow through the swim lane, if you need things to move faster, then you expand the swim lane by giving it more money.
The reason why I like the rent analogy, because A, everybody gets it. You don't, like,
exactly.
Doesn't matter whether you're a junior PM or a CEO, you get it. And when you rent, let's say you're renting a house from me, right? I have the house and you're renting it from me. I'm not going to tell you what to do in that house. I'm just going to tell you, like, this is the house.
That's a great point. Yep.
And there are going to be different activities throughout the house depending on the room you're in. I don't care. It's yours. You do with whatever you want as long as you're paying. And so that's why we would prefer to, and we have in the past said, look, this is the outcome you want. You want a safe roof over your head.
Right.
That's going to be, you know, $5,000 a month. That's the rent.
Yes.
Oh, you want a team that's going to deliver on this outcome? Then this is the rent. Yeah. Done. Easy.
100%. Yep.
Don't talk about tasks, because all of those things are like subjective. They're like, well.
And they are, to your point, to be fair to you, they are surrogates for hours. They're just a replacement for hours. It's a different grammar of it.
They're also subjective. So they really just become a pain. And then it's like, well, you know, we're going to build this page and it's going to take us 10 items, like we're going to need put these 10 elements in there. And they were like, well, it doesn't seem that complicated.
Right,
I can do that in words. You're like, okay, well, fuck you. Go away. Anyway, we got to wrap this up.
I think we got to end every podcast on fuck you. I think that was the way to wrap it up. That was perfect. All right.
You can't
have a great weekend. Fuck you.
Yeah.
I'll see you next week. Be good.
Cheers, mate.
Bye.